This paper is in part, it's something that I started thinking about in reaction to empirical work done by other people over the past decade or so in response to a paper that Michael Heller and I wrote in 1998 on the tragedy of the anti-commons in biomedical research. And in our paper, we expressed a concern at a proliferation of intellectual property rights in upstream biomedical research could paradoxically impede downstream product development, drug development, as the costs mounted to clear and negotiate all of the necessary rights, leading to transaction costs and holdups. Some readers took away from our paper a different worry about the impact of patents on the upstream research enterprise itself. And so a number of empirical investigations ensued, triggered by concerns within the scientific community that the anti-commons was going to be an obstacle to ongoing scientific research. So the National Academies of Science and the American Association for the Advancement of Science CIPI project, I can't remember exactly what CIPI stands for, Studies of Intellectual Property in the Public Interest or something like that, they conducted these empirical studies to measure the impact of intellectual property on the work of scientists. So although they were testing a hypothesis that was different from the one that we had posed in our article, the resulting data were nonetheless quite interesting to me. In particular, one that's gotten a lot of attention is the data of John Walsh and Wes Cohen, who conducted interviews and survey research and found that scientists rarely reported that patents were a problem for them. In fact, they seemed to be entirely oblivious to the patents that they were surely infringing. They never searched for patents, and they mostly got away with it. It was very rare for patent owners to assert their patent rights against researchers, to call them to their attention, even when they were working in fields that were characterized by extensive patenting. At the same time, they found that something more problematic was obstacles to gaining access to materials and data that they could not reproduce on their own. That's where the problem was. So the need to negotiate and reach agreement ex ante over terms of access to these resources that were from which people could be excluded unless they persuaded the owner to share them, those were the obstacles that actually had the an effect of delaying research and sometimes leading to Merck says no. If you're Merck, maybe you can overcome it if you care enough. But a lot of low value exchanges. The research was not looking at the impact on downstream product development, which had been our worry. The research was looking at the impact of patent rights on research, which is a relatively low value activity. So maybe if there's a blockbuster drug in view, not a problem, you'll clear the necessary rights. But if you're doing upstream research where values are a lot more uncertain and speculative, you're not going to do it. But patents alone rarely have that effect. Scientists simply ignored the patents, and patent holders ignored the infringement. And Walsh and Cohen characterized this as a working solution that avoided the development of an anti-commons. But of course, the working solution was patent infringement. Some people characterized it more more charitably as something like a de facto research exemption from infringement liability, but it was a little bit disturbing as a workaround. So for me, though, this highlighted the importance of something that Michael and I had overlooked, which was what I call the burden of inertia in determining the relationship between transaction costs and use. So where high transaction costs high transaction costs limit use of a proprietary resource depends not only on the level of the transaction cost, but on where the burden of inertia lies in the absence of somebody being motivated to overcome those transaction costs. So with patents, the burden of inertia is on the owner to to find infringers, monitor their activities, assert your rights, pursue them. The higher that burden, the more likely it is that the use is going to proceed without a license. So high transaction costs with the burden of inertia on the owner are actually protective of use and make an anti-commons less likely, while lower transaction costs are less protective of use. With MTAs, material transfer agreements where they found the problem, the burden of inertia is in the opposite direction. The burden of inertia is on the user to persuade the owner to share. And in that context, the higher the burden, the less share materials, share data. There was a range of resources where they found there were more obstacles arising, but it's something that's costly to duplicate on your own, where you have to get the owner to share it with you.
Unlike a patent.
Exactly. Sometimes they converge. You might have, for example, a patented OncoMouse, you know, but the obstacle that matters, and you know, in the course of overcoming that obstacle, you might negotiate a patent license as well as getting access to the mouse. But the obstacle that causes people to stand up and take note and enter into the negotiations is the practically excludable resource, which is the tangible thing. So in that context, the higher the transaction cost, the more likely it is that you won't have use of the resource. And so that was an important refinement of the anti-commons hypothesis, that the burden of inertia matters. I don't want to dwell here, Scott.
I was just going to make sure I'm following.
Yeah, okay. Because I'm not there yet, but anyhow, yeah.
You're saying the higher the transaction cost,
the less likely use is when the burden of inertia is on the user. The higher the transaction cost, the more likely use is when the burden of inertia is on the owner, right? Now, a few years later, Mark Lemley published an interesting essay called Ignoring Patents, in which he claimed, and I think plausibly, although on the basis of limited evidence, that this phenomenon of ignoring patents is not confined to the activities of research, that it's quite widespread, even in commercial contexts. Not so much in pharma, but in a lot of other contexts where commercial firms engaged in big projects simply ignore patents, and patent owners let them get away with it. So many owners either don't know, don't bother to sue. So I found this a little bit more disturbing, although not really surprising. It all makes sense, really. It's disturbing if you take as a benchmark the expectation that people are going to follow the law. And we have rules of patent law. There's a lot of rhetoric in patent law and a lot of rules of patent law that seem to have that assumption built into them. We promote compliance on the part of users, and we also promote enforcement of patents on the part of owners. We promote compliance through remedies by making it risky for users to ignore patents by subjecting them to damage and liability, injunctive liability. We make willful infringement subject to higher damages. We promote enforcement through doctrines of latches and estoppel that also make it risky for owners to simply ignore their arsenal of patents. But nonetheless, compliance and enforcement are inevitably imperfect. There's lots of information costs, lots of transaction costs that make it inevitable that you're going to have a lot of unlicensed use. Information costs are on both sides. They limit users' awareness of the patents that they might be infringing. They limit owners' awareness of infringement. Transaction costs may interfere with both, assertion of patents and also licensing transactions. So much of the time, it simply makes sense for owners and users both to ignore patents rather than to incur these costs. Now, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? Reactions in the literature have been quite mixed. There's a group of scholars that I call, these are not crisp categories, but that I call the lamenters in the paper, who think it's bad. They suggest various ways of bringing about a closer correspondence between the scope of formal patent rights and actual behavior of technologists. So Besson and Moyer argue for clarifying boundaries to improve the notice function of patents, make it easier to avoid or less costly to avoid inadvertent infringement. Mark Lemley has argued for a range of changes that would not only make patent boundaries clearer, but do so at an earlier stage in the process, that would improve incentives to search for patents, that would reform willful infringement doctrine, make license terms more transparent, et cetera. Interesting paper by a woman named Kara Moorcroft. She's concerned that all of this unlicensed use is encouraging patent scofflaws, and that's bad for the patent system, and that we should either stop this either by doing more to encourage enforcement, such as cost shifting, she suggests, or reform patent law perhaps to redefine as lawful behavior that currently counts as infringement, like research use. So there's this group of scholars that say what we should do is try to bring closer alignment between rules and behavior. Then there's another group of scholars that I call the apologists, who take a more benign view of this phenomenon, that they see unlicensed use as maybe a good thing, that maybe it's a partial solution to to what might otherwise be, you know, possible excesses of the patent system. You get a flavor of this in Walsh and Cohen's presentation of their data, suggesting characterizing the unlicensed use in research as a working solution. Catherine Strandberg has argued that maybe ignoring patents in research is an affirmative social norm within the research community that's enforced, that serves the interests of the research community. Paul Heald has an interesting paper where he sort of stakes out a middle ground. He says that, you know, the purpose of the patent system is to reduce the cost of contracting, but the costs of contracting are still high, and that our remedies should not always encourage ex ante contracting, which might be inefficient. In some circumstances, it makes more sense to let the use proceed, and that determine the scope of remedies after the fact. But the remedies should not be set so high as to encourage inefficient transacting. So this is a group of people that see some unlicensed use as maybe making sense in certain contexts. None of these apologist scholars is offering a robust defense of the status quo of a system that offers expansive patent rights that are burdened with high information costs and transaction costs that lead to non-compliance and non-enforcement. At most, maybe they're arguing that if we have an excessive level of rights formally on the books, maybe costs that limit enforcement would lead to more efficient outcomes than we would otherwise have. But that invites the conclusion that we might do better to dial down both the level of rights and the level of costs. And so what I want to explore in this paper is that maybe there's something to be said for a regime that has both high levels of rights and high costs that leave those rights unenforced much of the time. And this is kind of I'm a little uneasy about it. Transaction costs and information costs don't have a lot of defenders out there. I'm not finding a rich literature. Maybe some of you can point me towards it. But one thing, you know, there's always something to be said for the status quo, which is that, you know, any changes have unintended consequences. And so if you have a better understanding of just what the status quo is doing, at a minimum, you're less likely to. Oh, you have some of this literature for me? No. Yeah. Is it a short question?
No.
Because I haven't really gotten out my. Let me just get out. I'm almost to the point. I really want your question, but I'm almost to the point where I've sort of said, I want to make my sort of weak justification for the status quo. So I see three, well, really two, basically, two benefits primarily to this system, to a combination of high levels of protection and high costs that limit the circumstances in which behavior conforms to that high level of rights. First is basically that it's a filter, that high information costs and high transaction costs serve as a filter that weeds out low-value rights, low-value transactions, while retaining strong rights for matters where there's really higher values at stake. And that can be a good thing, because it may be that you need strong rights in some contexts and you don't need any rights in other contexts, but it's very hard to get there in your rights definition. So it can be sort of similar. There's a literature on patent maintenance fees that makes a similar point. That patent maintenance fees make it more costly to maintain patent rights over time, and that leads to abandonment of low-value patents. But unlike these patent maintenance fees, which lead to the loss of patent rights entirely, high information costs and high transaction costs can cause owners to retain their rights, and they can pick when to enforce them and enforce them in high-value contexts while ignoring them in low-value contexts. And that might be a better filter in some context, particularly if you have kind of a dual use technology that's useful in research, but that also has some commercial applications, for example. And what's nice about it is they have this effect without the need for creating formal exceptions to infringement liability for de minimis activities or research exemption or something that can be hard to craft in a way that gets it right. And you also don't need to set you don't need to set different levels of protection or different remedies for different contexts that can be costly to administer. So maybe de facto restrictions on enforcement serve as a pretty good approximation of when you need the rights and when you don't, and allow you to retain a higher level of protection than you otherwise could get away with. So for example, owners who require strong rights, like the pharmaceutical industry, get to set the level of rights higher than they would if everybody else had to abide by those rights. It might otherwise trigger objections from, say, universities if they thought these rights actually apply to us if they faced enforcement. So that's one trigger. It might be a filter. One justification for the patent, for the present system is it might be a pretty good filter. Another benefit of the status quo is that I think these costs make compliance and enforcement less likely in an uneven way. Compliance and enforcement remain likely in circumstances where the parties are sort of already in some sort of face-to-face contractual relationship, less likely as between strangers. And that can be a good thing. Contracting parties are already face-to-face. It's easier for them to monitor each other's behavior. They have a lot of information about each other. It's easy, relatively easy for them to contract over or to negotiate further about patent rights or whatever. It's a lot harder to monitor strangers, harder to find them, more costly to reach agreements with them. So there's an uneven impact that skews the protection in favor of people who are in a non-patent relationship with each other. And that makes more patent protection more effective where I think it's clearly more valuable, and less effective where its value is less clear. Patents, I think, are important in face-to-face contracting situations. They help parties enter into contracts. They help parties negotiate over contracts by protecting owners from users who walk away from the negotiations and take the technology with them. So in this context, costs are relatively unlikely to interfere with detection and enforcement, but you retain the rights. Strangers arguably owe less to patent owners. There's a literature out there about how we ought to have an independent inventor defense to infringement liability. I'm not sure I agree with that literature, but this is sort of an intermediate position. The status quo strikes a middle ground by making a remedy available, but less likely in the independent inventor context. One thing I haven't quite, one question that interests me that I haven't quite worked out is what is the impact on patent speculators? Is this going to create, I was thinking for a while, and I'm not sure this writes, but it might be that it makes enforcement less likely, that it makes enforcement less likely when patents are in the hands of speculators than when they're in the hands of technologists. And I'm not sure that's right, but the hypothesis is that information costs are lower for technological practitioners than for speculators who are not working in the field, that they can, that the information costs you, so, okay, maybe I'm wrong. That doesn't mean I'm wrong. But on the other hand, the enforcement costs may be lower for the speculators. That's my sort of first approximation. They have large portfolios that may provide economies of scale. They're less likely to come up empty-handed when they pursue enforcement if they have a large patent portfolio, et cetera. So I'm not sure which of these effects is going to dominate or what else might be going on. So I find myself cautiously joining the apologists, but unsure. Richard, thank you for your patience.
The one word that you did not mention here was the word benefit to the patentee by virtue of breach. So let me just give you two cases where I think it's a completely different dynamic. So one is the research exemption. Now let's suppose that Merck has a patent out there, and I know that somebody in the University of Chicago laboratory is using one of their subjects such that to test whether it's effective on something. And if it turns out it's negative, well, there's going to be no expanded market for the good. But if it turns out it's positive, they'll sell a lot of stuff on the commercial side.
Yeah.
I can understand perfectly well why they would say, let them just do this, so long as they're not competitive to us, they're going to be complementary goods. We're just going to kind of observe them and nothing. And this means that it's not that we can't find them out, we can't sue them. It's that we want them to do what they do. And when we had our conference in San Diego with our good friend Barney, right? Barney is not one of these lawyers. He's a general counsel. What is it?
Tessera.
Tessera. He was worried about they had technology out there. They licensed it to a bunch of people, and then there are a bunch of other people that come up. And they just decided to use it as a commercial competitor. And his attitude, well, I know who they are, and the question is, what kind of remedies could I get against them? And that's their end market, and for those people, of course, you really want to go after them and battle at that time. You as Tessera want to go after unauthorized people
who
are taking their end market and making it untenable. This is the scoffle of your other guys, your actual license users to do it. Because you favor the unlimited, the whole network will unravel. And at that point, the battle was over whether or not the licensor of a bunch of non-exclusive licensees should be able to get the eBay injunction relief, which I can guess and Mark was trying to disguise the argument. No. But to me, the two situations are completely different, and I think the industry guys have done it. So I think what you really want to do is just say there seems to be, at least in this area, a sensible sort of equilibrium under the current situation in which the beneficial uses to the patentee, when known, are not hacked, and the adverse ones are. And so you don't have to worry about that particular problem. You have to worry about its enforcement against people who are essentially taking away your income.
Well, I am less interested in that, but that's just not the question I'm interested in. I don't think so. I think what I'm interested in is, I'm somewhat interested in that, but I just think that's unproblematic. I trust patent owners to figure out for themselves whether they welcome an independent use of the invention because they think it's going to expand their market, or whether they don't. So I don't think, what I'm worried about is whether the information costs and the transaction costs are which play no role in that. Right, what I'm interested in is whether the information costs and transaction costs are limiting enforcement in circumstances where that could be a bad thing.
I think the transaction cost problem you're facing is the inability to get the injunction when you have a bunch of non-exclusive licensees is the central battle on that we have to face.
Richard, that's an issue. It's not.
That's not my issue. That's not what
I think it is.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, pretty quick comment.
Yes.
I think you're exactly right about the NPDs. You get that nice and sophisticated fashion. I guess I come out of thinking that they lower transaction costs, and that's what they're really good at. And they like that, you hate that for the reasons you gave, right? But I think that's one of the things they do. On low value, I guess I tweak it a little bit. I'd say low appropriable value. It's not that what we do is low value, but ideas you can't appropriate the value. That on the scaling point, so Tim Wu's got a paper on tolerated uses in copyright. You probably want to look at that. I think of the switch from copying on cassettes to Napster is precisely about the change in transaction costs and then how that percolates through the copyright system, right? They could, as it were, live with it when it was on cassettes, and when we could all share instantly with our friends in Siberia, the scale is so different, they couldn't live with it. Changing the transaction costs really matters.
Low appropriable value versus low value.
And then Tim Wu. I don't know what that paper says. I don't know if you just made the point.
Okay. You should look at
that.
Yeah. Mark.
So I'm actually quite agnostic on this question, right?
Yeah.
You put me in the lamenters, and in some sense, I don't think it is a perfect world, right? Although the question of whether a move from our current world towards, whether a change would in fact move us towards or away from a more perfect world is unclear.
As usual, your papers in both ways.
but I want to push on one potential cost, right? It's one of the things that the system you described does, it seems to me, and I think this is actually a characteristic that we saw Ian Kelly talk about yesterday, right, is it creates these sort of stochastic heavy enforcement. Right, so instead of a world in which everybody who comes up with a patent gets paid a reasonable licensing fee for that patent in a market transaction, mm-hmm. we have a world in which we all ignore patents in the IT industry. 90% of the time we get away with it, and 10% of the time we get really whacked with a $500 million verdict. Mm-hmm. And it's worth thinking, I mean, so, you know, maybe we care about equity. I'm not sure I particularly care about the fact that you were in one of the unlucky 10%, but it's worth thinking about. But it's also worth thinking about how that kind of reverse lottery effect might affect behavior, right? So ways in which people act when they're looking at sort of low probability of a really high bad outcome as a defendant, that might change behavior in ways we worry about. It also is worth thinking about the question of whether the uncertainty that's generated about the validity of the patents that sort of might or might not be asserted is relevant. And then I think it leads into the question of what's the role of aggregators, because I think one of the reasons the system works the way it does is that most of the patents are not in the hands of people whose sole interest in owning it is to make money from it. Right, from licensing it, right? They're people who are using it for defensive purposes, for cross-licensing purposes, for impressing their venture capitalists, whatever. As patent aggregators become a larger part of the marketplace, it may be that this low enforcement, high result thing breaks down, because more and more of the patent aggregators are in fact gonna have the incentive to enforce, and then the system comes out of
equilibrium. So you think it's not a matter of cost limiting enforcement, you think it's a matter of, and I guess maybe you're saying the same thing as Richard, which is interesting.
But you're both saying that what's really driving this is not that the costs are too high, but that in some contexts it's worth enforcement, and in some contexts it's not worth enforcement,
right.
Depending
and
on who wants to patent.
That's
a dynamic that's changing.
But that's
certainly
true with content.
Yeah, John.
So I think this relates to the last couple of questions. So, I mean, I'm also, you know, quite willing to count myself among the apologists in certain contexts, but this is one of those contexts. So, you know, on the one side, if you were to ramp up the transaction costs, you know, on the one side, there might be all these sorts of tax on researchers that don't occur. On the other hand, all the time people are going to litigate patents against one another, now the costs of those are going to be even higher. So we have some amount of activities that will always exist, which are now more expensive, more socially wasteful. I mean, some activities which are not going to exist. So the question is, what are the social gains from making sure that these sort of tax on researchers and whoever else don't exist? Well, I mean, part of the irony of this is what I take from, you know, your anti-commons paper and that literature, is that the problem with these, patent assaults on researchers and so forth derives in large degree from the transaction costs, right? So you have that, so maybe the thing is just perform the thought experiment, what if instead of raising them, we loaded them all to zero, right? So now we have all these researchers who have to pay licensing fees, but that might just be distributional. Maybe they're still going to get to do all the same research and it's all going to work out fine. They're paying a little bit of money here and there to various patent holders. The problem that doesn't exist is all these search costs and the licensing level, so all these transaction costs that actually make that research less likely to take place. So I think that the trick maybe is to convince us that, you know, by avoiding these sorts of patent holder research interactions, you're actually creating social gains that are going to outweigh all the other social costs imposed on people who are just going to go ahead and enforce those patents.
In the thought experiment where none of these costs exist, you don't need patents, right? You can costlessly get everybody to enter into transactions that will. So, I mean, I think we only have patents because we have these costs, and then the costs inherently limit the effectiveness of patents.
Right.
But you can sometimes make that, you can titrate up or down,
right.
Sometimes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. That's, yeah. Very good.
Yeah, Scott?
So, isn't it possible that there's a third category of people, and at least I've always thought of myself as being in this group, of not being an apologist for the enforcement costs leading to low enforcement, but being an advocate of the enforcement costs leading to low enforcement. I think that's a feature, not a bug in the system.
Well, that's what I'm trying to explore.
Yeah,
if you said that previously, I apologize.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, but then the question becomes how kind of, so Mark is worried about this, I think you call it the stochastic, heavy, kind of, you know, high. And for me, I've always viewed the copyright system as an example of that, when you see statutory damages and jail time. And what's nice about the patent system, and again, I've been a big fan of this, is to resist criminal liability, to resist statutory damages, precisely because the transaction costs of enforcement are high, and that leads to under-enforcement, and that's a feature, not a bug. Right.
I didn't follow that at all. Yeah.
Right.
So, it seems
so,
like those are.
No, but sorry, let me tie it together.
Yeah.
So that if I have to prove that you're infringing, and the only thing I get from proving that you're infringing is a reasonable royalty, and we might disagree with each other over whether it's 1.5x or x, but I'm still an advocate about keeping it far below 10x, right? And as long as it's far below 10x, I'll rationally not sue a whole lot of people, precisely because it costs me a lot to sue, and I don't get anything from suing. I get 79 cents or $1,000 for academic uses, but it's $1 million to bring a lawsuit. So I don't spend $1 million to get $1,000. So I under-enforce against large numbers of low or appropriable value users. And that's a feature of the system. And I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I think that's a like, at least for me, an unabashed proud plus. That's not an apology, and that's not a bug. It's like a whoopee.
So it's Duke 76 to your work, because maybe I have nothing left to say.
No. You do. You're okay. Adding up a lot. But then my last question would be, what label would you give this in other settings? So, I mean, in the University of Chicago, there's a lot of security because it's privately owned land, but it's also because it's not a safe neighborhood. There's a lot of privately owned land where there's actually not a lot of security, nor are there people collectors. So, you know, Donald Trump ain't thought of being a nice guy. And yet, you and I can go to Trump Plaza and have lunch. You know, there's nobody with a gun, you know, checking our ID, and there's no one selling his tickets. He rationally chooses to engage in none of the transaction costs of enforcement. And that could be a feature of the property system, not a bug. And what you could be highlighting are ways in which the patent system operates the same way, that it allows large numbers of low appropriable value users to come and use, and it allows them to do it because the property owner says to herself, it would be a nightmare for me to keep these people out, so I'm just going to let them in.
So the Trump example, obviously he's for licensees, he wants us to come have lunch. That's how he's exploiting his property. That's not something that he doesn't see worth enforcing against us. So it's quite different. But it's more like what Richard was saying, that there might be,
I think a lot of the George is the man. I think a lot of these are, in fact, I don't think it's a problem finding these people or even enforcing it.
Yeah,
they,
especially the ones that...
to do so. I mean, am I wrong? You probably send them stuff, right? And give them advice on the telephone.
And the cost of, the cost of enforcement far outweighs any benefit you get from squashing.
I think that's right. I think a lot of the research exemption stuff, that's right. I'm trying to generalize beyond that and ask, do we welcome this regime more broadly? Can we say with any confidence that the context that Mark was talking about in his ignoring patents papers, where you have a semiconductor fabricator ignoring a whole range of patents, for example, can we say anything favorable about costs that impede enforcement more broadly?
Favorable. I mean, so yeah. For example, the aggregator point, they're not going to go sue academics because even aggregating, the appropriable value they get from academics won't be high. But they will preserve the option to sue a competing, or I guess Mark would say non-competing, but a commercial provider of academics. An aggregator might sue an academic warehouse provider. And that's actually, even in the copyright space, you see those lawsuits against Kinko's for that reason. Right? So they're not suing the universities.
Right.
Now in the copyright space they are, but that's because the copyright space allows for criminal liability and statutory damages.
Mass production of students.
Can I ask a sort of philosophical question?
Yes, please.
One of the issues that you raise is, are we comfortable with a system where people consciously on both sides either break the law or accept that we're breaking the law.
Yeah.
But is using an invention that's covered by a patent without paying a patent royalty breaking the law?
It's infringement. It's patent infringement. If somebody sued, if somebody
it's
were
a tort, it's not a crime.
It's not a crime, but
it's not really a. But that's what I mean. There really isn't any value. I guess breaking the law suggests there's some value judgment.
Not
some philosophical value in not doing that, but. There's not.
Well, I think that there is some loss. I mean, where I started this is I was thinking that there is some loss to the prestige of the patent system if it is widely violated, and that can lead to more violations. It can head you down a slippery slope. And maybe it's not malum in se, right? Maybe it's, but it, but not.
Yeah, but nonetheless, it's... Oh, it's clearly malum prohibitum,
well,
I think.
Well, we breach contract all the time.
I mean, there's a big debate in contract law about whether that is, in fact, relevant at all. Yeah. What is a contract but a promise to either perform or pay?
But this is outside of, this is not a contract we're talking about. We're talking about a patent out there and that somebody else has the option of enforcing against you. But you're saying the fact that somebody could sue you and that they don't choose to sue you, that it's wrong to think of that as a law violation.
But the question of whether it has a moral valence,
I think
matters. Among other things, it matters because we increasingly are setting our remedy regimes in patent law with an eye towards deterrence, right? With an eye towards making sure you don't get away with it, or moving towards an unjust enrichment scheme. And if in fact, right, we shouldn't be thinking of this as bad acts to be stopped, but a cost of doing business.
Is it a bit efficient?
Right. Then we might want to sort of rethink how it is we
dial down the rhetoric of the remedies cases, and you've made that point with Chris Katropia, in that paper.
I think it's great. This is useful.
Okay. So nobody's pointing me towards that literature that says that information costs and transaction costs are good things.
Oh, I'm sending it.
Oh, you're sending it to me. Okay, excellent.
I mean, Tim, who may say it in copyright. I don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah?
I don't think we're saying that. The point that I'm saying about the research exemption and so forth is that you choose not to enforce it.
Right. You think there's perfect information out there.
On those cases, it's pretty close to it. If you go back, you wrote that little piece on Maddie, remember?
Yeah, in Science,
That was about the only case in which we've seen somebody actually do this. And of course, it was completely atypical. Because you had a lab moving from Stanford to and they were fighting over who would keep the intellectual property. So it had nothing whatsoever to do with the creation of complementary goods. It had to do with direct competition between two institutions. Well, that case...
That actually is what happened.
Yeah, no.
Duke fired the guy.
Yeah, okay.
The patent was beside the point.
Beside the point in this grudge match, I guess it was then. And you know, whenever you start seeing atypical cases out there, attributing strong rights and nobody following up on it, it cannot be that there's a high transaction cost explanation. There's got to be somebody who would find it in their interest. It's a situation in which it's like the tolerated intruders. You're letting them there because of the benefit side to you.
I'm actually not trying to focus on that problem.
I understand that. I know that. But I'm saying, but that's the high side. I think I would argue that the problem is, to go back to it again, is that in some cases the remedies that you get aren't good enough. And so one of the reasons that you don't sue is that if you get bad remedial protection, it's no longer worth it. And for those cases, it seems to be the remedy is to go back to the kind of injunctive ruling rather than to some kind of squishy damage ruling. So, I mean, I know that's the side that you're worried about, and I think on that side there's a problem. But I think on the other side there's nothing. That's all.
Okay, and I am ending ahead of schedule.